I'm John Fetterson from the North Carolina Reading Service, providing the Indie Week for our blind and print-impaired listeners each week. And today's current issue, dated August 5th, 2020. All of our regular musicians were not available at the casual labor pickup today, so our theme music today is being performed by me, John Fetterson, on violin and piano simultaneously. Don't ask. So let's get on with the actual articles in the Indie Week for this week. Mr. T. Greg Doucette leads off with his Voices column, a local attorney, criminal justice reform advocate, and host of a podcast, which I cannot tell you the title of because of language needs. And this one's called The UNC System Needs an Enema. You might think the once-in-a-century pandemic jeopardizing our 17-campus North Carolina system would focus the minds of North Carolina, of those politicians entrusted with governing it, that a disease threatening the lives of students, staff, and faculty in equal measure would trigger a degree of sobriety and seriousness when it comes to conducting the public business. But you would be very, very wrong. This past month has confirmed the UNC System Office and its Board of Governors continue to play games with taxpayers' money and students' educations, even in the COVID-19 era. Consider three burgeoning scandals to illustrate the point. Last month, ousted East Carolina University Chancellor Cecil Stanton, a different guy from the other ousted East Carolina Chancellor who came after him, filed a defamation lawsuit against the UNC system, former Board of Governors Chairman Harry Smith, Attorney Peter Romery, and others. Stanton claims Romery, working for a company called Q Verity, which in turn was working for Smith, who in turn was working for UNC, went out of his way to badmouth Stanton to a presidential search committee of a Texas university. Stanton was a shoe-in for the job, he insists, and only missed out because of an email from, quote, John Q. Public at ECU, with a lengthy document attached known as the dossier. Seriously. The lawsuit seems tailor-made for media attention, but little else. For example, North Carolina has a one-year statute of limitations on defamation claims, yet all of the BOG defendants, except Smith, were sued after that deadline had passed. Stanton claims the dossier that so damaged his prospect was written by Romery, but ECU's student newspaper got its hands on an affidavit from a former ECU professor claiming she compiled it years ago. The email, quote, from, quote, John Q. Public at ECU turned out not to be an email at all, as an FOI request to the Texas University for the electronic correspondent netted instead a physical envelope mailed out of an Asheville post office. And I already disclosed in my column back in May that John Q. Public is a former client of mine, who is not Peter Romery. With Stanton's lawsuit now in the wild and naming several Board of Governors members as defendants, sources now contend Stanton lied about his salary and credentials as part of the application process that made him ECU's chancellor in the first place. It will be interesting to see what other skeletons tumble out of the closet as that lawsuit moves forward. Not to be outdone in bizarre legal maneuvers, Board of Governors Chairman Randy Ramsey, the same guy who misrepresented his academic credentials for years, tried to convince the board to misrepresent the tenure of interim president Bill Roper. Ramsey asked the board to remove the interim title, making Roper a full president for a week. Board member Marty Kotis reportedly made the motion at Ramsey's urging, only to then withdraw it, also at Ramsey's urging, when opposition became apparent. The Board of Governors then took a straw poll on the idea, which failed decisively. This is not the sort of thing that can lawfully be considered in a closed session. North Carolina's Open Meetings Act requires closed session items to be disclosed to the public in advance and requires all votes, including straw polls, to be done in open session. But the idea that Ramsey and Kotis would even propose this sort of nonsense as a parting gift to the interim president who gave us silent sham is astonishing. Then we get to the new president himself, Peter Hans. When it leaked out of the General Assembly that Hans was going to be the new UNC system president, it also leaked that current Speaker of the House, Tim Moore, would be made ECU chancellor as part of the deal. The Speaker's office tutted the idea, since it would suggest the Speaker knew Republicans might lose the House majority and he would no longer be Speaker. And those who held Hans in high regard, myself included at the time, had a hard time believing he would sully himself by striking that sort of deal in the first place. Yet, at the very same Board of Governors meeting, the board got to review a brand new revision to the university's policies on chancellor searches. The policy would allow the UNC president to designate two people as automatic finalists for any vacant chancellorship, and those finalists would be included among the list of candidates the campus board of trustees sends back to the UNC president for final selection. It completely eliminates the vetting process for any politician of the president's choosing. It's comically bad governance in normal times. Against the backdrop of the House Speaker being guaranteed a chancellorship in exchange for Hans's ascension as president, it should be downright criminal. The board is slated to vote on the policy change at its September meeting. Many of us hoped those entrusted with running the UNC system would get their acts together after their silent sham deal exploded and the coronavirus took its place. That optimism appeared to have been misguided. We'll see in the months ahead just how badly we were wrong. Here we go with the good, the bad, and the awful column. Good. Duke COVID-19 treatment. Scientists at Duke got approval to start trials for a promising antibody treatment for COVID-19 that could serve as an early defense while a full vaccine is developed. The treatment involves isolating antibodies from the blood of recovered patients and transferring them to patients who are at high risk for the disease. It's not quite a vaccine, as it involves multiple treatments over time rather than a single treatment, but it could provide a vital stopgap for patients over the next few months. A statement from the Duke Human Vaccine Institute says the trials will likely begin in January, and researchers are also working on a pan-coronavirus vaccine that can help medical professionals get the jump on any future coronaviruses. A bad award of the week goes to Hurricane Isaias. It made landfall in Ocean Isle Beach as a Category 1 storm around 11 p.m. last night. Flooding and heavy winds knocked out power for over 370,000 homes statewide, and Governor Cooper reported that one person was killed by a tornado that formed during the storm. Isaias could certainly have been worse, but that's not much consolation for families who've had their homes flooded, cars overturned, and businesses hammered during an already fraught economic moment. As Cooper told Good Morning America, it's double trouble, really, when you're dealing with a hurricane and COVID-19 at the same time. And the IndyWeek's awful award, election rhetoric. When Fox News Chris Wallace directly asked Donald Trump if he would commit to accepting a loss in November, electoral loss, he ominously said he would, quote, have to see. On Thursday, he tweeted that mail-in voting necessitated by the pandemic would create the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history, and suggested delaying the election, quote, until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. Putting aside the president's ongoing war against the very postal service that facilitates fair and accurate mail-in voting, and the fact that a president does not have the power to delay an election, it's worrying to see Trump already throwing the results of the election into doubt. We're just 90 days out from the presidential election, and Trump's message to his base is clear. If he loses at the ballot box, it's because the system was rigged against him, not because of the handling of the pandemic or the allegations of sexual abuse or the Ukraine scandal or, well, you can fill in the blank. We have a regional from Durham now, Tomasi McDonald's column, Den of Inequity. Last month, members of a task force whose focus is Increasing Racial Equity in Durham called on city leaders to, quote, formally acknowledge and apologize for the city's historical compliance for redlining, discrimination in housing covenants, urban renewal projects, and the neglect of historically black cemeteries, unquote. The report centers on the unkept promises of urban renewal that destroyed thousands of black-owned houses and hundreds of businesses in the Haiti district with the creation of North Carolina 147 Highway. On July 23rd, the 17-member Racial Equality Task Force submitted the visionary, tough-minded 60-page report to Durham City Council. Mindful of the Black Lives Matter signs on front lawns and white residents joining anti-racism protests, the task force offered a challenge to the city and private institutions in the report. The report's executive summary says, "We need to be not merely anti-racist in thought, but actively and continuously anti-racist indeed." Later, in a summary of the racial wealth gap, the task force urged the city in bold print to put your money where your mouth is. Prior to submitting its report, the task force examined data and spoke with elected officials and residents across the city, including citizens in underserved communities. The report noted the distrust in communities hit hard by gentrification and encouraged city officials to be more accessible to the city's black and brown citizens, saying, "Those closest to the pain should be closest to the power." The city's first racial equity task force was formed in October of 2018, the brainchild of council member and Mayor Pro Tem Jillian Johnson. The multiracial task force is chaired by retired Superior Court Judge Elaine O'Neill, who is now interim dean at the NC Central School of Law, and Karen Haldeman, an anthropologist, writer, and activist. The group spent nearly 2 years studying wealth and the economy, criminal justice, health and environmental justice, education, and public history. The conclusions in each area were blunt. The report says, quote, "Our criminal legal system is working as it was designed to protect white people by controlling people of color," unquote. Likewise, the nation's housing system was created to maintain private white-owned land by controlling people of color's access to land. Blacks, people of color, and poor whites have lacked access to build and sustain wealth. Meanwhile, the healthcare system values the well-being of white bodies at the expense of the bodies of people of color. Finally, the report indicts an educational system that was, quote, "designed to indoctrinate all students with the internalized belief that the white race is superior," unquote. The task force members note that their assertions may cause discomfort among white residents. So be it, the report states. Sit with that. If we are to dismantle racism, we must begin to look at how our systems are designed to advantage white people rather than merely focusing on how our systems have failed people of color. That said, the task force sounded a cautionary note, quote, "White discomfort is powerful. It can lead white people to disrupt anti-racist work or to become participants in the work. We're calling on white Durhamites to embrace this discomfort and actively learn from seasoned white anti-racists how to live racially just lives and how to do this work without causing more harm." The task force dismissed race-neutral solutions that ultimately perpetuate the privileging of white Americans, noting that for all of the city's celebration of inclusion, its downtown development plan, including the American Tobacco Campus, quote, "directly resulted in the resegregation of downtown Durham," unquote, and the surrounding areas. The plan did not apply equity to ensure the growth and success of black citizens. This is a re-traumatization of the experience of Haiti and a failure that the city needs to immediately address. The report noted that the city, however well-intentioned, has limited power over many of these issues. State and federal government not only have more power and capacity, but also place limitations on city capacity to remedy long-term institutional inequities. The task force also recognized that it cannot undo such a deeply ingrained system of racial inequity in one fell swoop. Nor will the work of undoing racial inequity be the work of one city council or one mayor. The task force promised that, quote, reimagining, realigning, and sustaining an equitable infrastructure will not be a comfortable process, but it can be a liberating one, especially for white people, unquote. Using a 1925 Ku Klux Klan march past the White House as a launching point, the task force surmised that substantive change has not come. The report says, Black Americans are still enslaved and now in what is called prison, and slaves are now called inmates, felons, or defendants. In other words, the terms have changed, but the outcomes and inequities have not. Black people in Durham still disproportionately live in substandard housing, have less wealth, and are being killed by the police. The task force offered a sweeping list of recommendations, including the comprehensive collection of data to understand the intersections of race, gender, and disability experiences. The group says the city should create a database of business ownership by race, ethnicity, and gender, and create access to credit available for Black and Latinx business owners. In the criminal justice sector, the task force recommends a database that tracks police misconduct and a community oversight board with subpoena powers to review it. Health and environmental recommendations include focusing on gun violence prevention, mapping areas that have been designated as food deserts, and making efforts to improve air, water, and soil quality in low-income communities. The task force also recommends increased funding for eviction diversion programs and ramps up municipal efforts to increase home ownership in historically Black communities. The group recommends that the school system should track the number of students who are deemed transient due to the housing crisis, evaluate language access for non-English speaking students, and reevaluate the role of school resource officers. The task force says there needs to be a new narrative about the city's history that includes voices that have been ignored or dismissed, suggesting the building of a history museum that collaborates with storytellers, the NC Central Department of History, and local activist groups to share a more comprehensive history of the city. Citing the racialized impact of the COVID pandemic, the task force recommends that the city and county's major institutions, including government, banking, and philanthropic industries, quote, invest and reallocate resources to communities of color in order to build an inclusive economy where we all thrive, unquote. The report found that while inequities affect people of color most profoundly, they also undermine community life for everyone. It cited numerous studies that show unjust societies as being less safe, healthy, and happy, but more fearful. The task force said that its report is in solidarity with the tens of thousands of Americans who are in the streets protesting systemic racism, and praised Asheville city leaders who approved reparations for its Black citizens last month. At one point, the report even struck a poetic sensibility that recalled the best of American activism. Quote, it is time to recognize the stagnation of the poisoned water we all swim in and deal with the reality of the bloodshed that taints the sea. Another Thomas E. McDonald column, Panic Attack. A state trooper's violent encounter with two teens and the cover-up attempt that followed results in no charges and many questions. A state highway patrol trooper and his fiancée have been accused of assaulting two Black teenagers, holding one at gunpoint while the other was bashed in the back of the head with a police-issued walkie-talkie, according to a complaint filed against the NC Department of Safety. Two Raleigh attorneys filed the complaint last week. It accuses NC State Highway Patrol Trooper Sergeant Sean Luther Bridges and Leon Weber, who are white, of assaulting the teens while they were visiting a home their mother had under contract for purchase in Wendell. On September 10th, just after 6 p.m., two teens left their father's house on Old Johnson Road to visit their future home on Terracotta Way, which was still under construction. The attorneys say Bridges, a resident of the neighborhood, was not in uniform and did not identify himself as a law enforcement officer when he prevented Xavier Atkinson, then 14, from leaving the premises. The attorneys say Bridges also threw Xavier's 19-year-old sister, Mahogany, in a ditch, handcuffed her, and held her at gunpoint when she tried to intervene. Weber, Bridges' fiancée, bashed Xavier Atkinson in the back of the head with Bridges' police-issued walkie-talkie, according to the complaint. The teen's mother, Beth Harris, is a mental health nurse at UNC Healthcare Addiction Treatment Center at Wake Brook in Raleigh. She is 200% sure racism fueled Bridges' behavior and said her children would not have been subjected to that type of mistreatment if they were white. Never, never, she told the Indy. They thought because they were African-American children, they were in the house stealing. The Johnston County Sheriff's Office even went over to their aunt's house and searched the home to see if they had stolen something. Johnston County deputies did not find any stolen items, but in the sometimes illogical world of law enforcement reasoning, the Atkinson children were still threatened with charges of assault on a law enforcement official. In an 18-page claim for damages filed July 23rd, Raleigh attorneys Donald Huggins and James Hairston assert that the State Department of Public Safety deployed an African-American Highway Patrol trooper, 1st Sergeant D.L. Mobley, to empathize with Harris as a fellow African-American, said the complaint. Mobley told Harris that he didn't want to see Mahogany charged because he knew how a criminal record could hinder a young black woman. Huggins and Hairston say Mobley might have identified with Harris, but they also think his actual intent was to cover up the incident. In essence, Mobley dangled a quid pro quo before Harris, said Huggins and Hairston. If the teen's mother dropped the issue against Bridges' wife, then Mahogany Atkinson and Xavier Atkinson would not be criminally charged, the claim says. 2 days after the confrontation on September 12th, Johnston County District Attorney Susan Doyle reviewed the incident, sent an email to Mobley that recommended criminal charges against the Atkinson siblings, but not against Bridges or Weber. Sergeant Bridges, Doyle wrote in the email, did not commit any crimes. On September 17, Mobley came to Harris's workplace to ask her to drop a potential civil lawsuit against Bridges' fiancé in exchange for the dismissal of criminal charges that were pending against her children. Mobley called me at work and said he didn't want to talk with me over the phone. He wanted to face-to-face, Harris says. That's what prompted me to record what he needed to tell me to save my kids. Whatever Mobley's intentions were, what he proposed to Harris on September 17th appeared to be an attempt to blackmail her. On Harris's audio recording, Mobley can be heard telling her that Bridges' concern for his fiancée was behind the offer. The mental health nurse told Mobley that Bridges should be tested for drugs after his encounter with her children. He was high. Something was wrong with him, Harris later told the Indy. I've been a substance abuse nurse for 10 years. I know high when I see it. My daughter said the same thing. His eyes were glassy, Mommy. On the recording, Mobley told Harris that Bridges had tested negative for alcohol, but he was not tested for drugs, though state troopers are subjected to random drug tests. Mobley told Harris that if she could, quote, see it in her heart to not go after Bridges' fiancé, then these charges against her children will not be filed. Bottom line, we got to make these charges go away because in my heart it won't right, Mobley later added. Harris told Mobley she had canceled the contract for the home. My children are traumatized, she said, and it's not fair for them to be scared when they walk out their door. We've already been branded. Mobley, after speaking with Harris, decided not to charge the children, Harrison told the Indy last week, but many unanswered questions remain. According to the claim, which paints a vivid picture of the incident, the trooper's encounter with the Atkinsons began with an angry and profane command instead of a simple introduction. Harris said it's yet another example of a systemic police brutishness that sparked global outrage with the murder of George Floyd on Memorial Day. As outlined in the claim, the teens used an all-terrain vehicle to visit the house, which the sales contract allowed them to do. They parked the ATV in front of the home and stayed inside for less than 10 minutes. Upon leaving, they were approached by Bridges, a tall, muscular Caucasian man with tattoos, wearing shorts and a t-shirt, who immediately began to yell at them. When Xavier started the ATV, Bridges yelled, "Don't crank that loud stuff up!" Not sure what Bridges had said, Xavier shut off the ATV and asked his sister if she had heard. That's when Mahogany asked Bridges, "What did you say?" Bridges continued to walk toward the Atkinson and told them again, "Don't cut that loud stuff on!" Mahogany told Bridges, "You could have said that better. We're only trying to see our house. Do you know where we are? We are in the country. I've been riding this area for years, and this is our home." "This is not your house," Bridges angrily stated, still approaching. The teen grew fearful and asked her brother to go get their mother. When Xavier mounted the ATV and started it, Bridges stepped in front of the vehicle and attempted to grab the handlebars. Visibly angry, he commanded Xavier to turn the ATV off. Xavier says he did, though Bridges later wrongfully asserted that the teen had tried to hit him with the vehicle, according to the complaint. Mahogany stepped between Bridges and her brother. Bridges grabbed Mahogany Atkinson by her wrists and slung her into a nearby ditch, the attorneys claim. He then proceeded to illegally restrain her by sitting on her torso with his arm underneath her breasts. Bridges then identified himself as law enforcement and repeatedly stated that Mahogany Atkinson was under arrest for assault on a government official. He yelled to his significant other to retrieve his firearm, walkie-talkie, and handcuffs. As Xavier tried to pull the state trooper off his sister, Weber, who is not named in the complaint, struck Xavier in the back of the head with Bridges' walkie-talkie. Xavier Atkinson grabbed the woman's hair to prevent her from striking him again and then escaped to the ATV, driving to his aunt's home where his mother was visiting, according to the complaint. When Xavier got there, his mother was alarmed by the reckless way he pulled into the yard and the blood on his shirt and face. He was frantic, speechless, only to say his sister's name and the word accident. Harris, her best friend, and other family members got into a minivan and rushed to the new home site, where Harris saw her daughter in handcuffs near the ditch. Bridges had his gun drawn, pointed at Mahogany's torso. "Don't effing move," Bridges said to them, and they all raised their hands in the air. Harris attempted to explain the situation to Bridges, but the trooper swung and aimed his firearm in the direction of Harris and stated, "Shut the F up!" He then used his radio to call for backup. Harris tried to reason with Weber. "Shut the F up," Weber said to Harris. "The more you talk, the more problems you will have." Mahogany, who has asthma, was having trouble breathing under Bridges' restraint. After several moments of pleading, Bridges finally allowed Harris's best friend to administer a dose from an inhaler to Mahogany Atkinson, the claim says. When multiple law enforcement agencies arrived, Mahogany was placed in the back of a Johnston County Sheriff's Office patrol car where she had two panic attacks. Xavier was taken to the Wake Med Children's Emergency Room after Johnston County deputies arrived at his aunt's home, searched it, and detained him in a manner that injured the teen. When Harris looked at the video of George Floyd's murder with Xavier, he told her, "Mommy, that's how they had me." Harris says he told me 2 months later that he couldn't take the pain. He had torn ligaments in his elbow and his knee. Harris says she intends to file a legal claim against the Johnston County Sheriff's Office. "I want to see the cameras," she said. "My son has been emotionally scarred since that happened. He is a very angry young black child right now. I told my mother my daughter could have been a Sandra Bland." Doyle told Indy that Bridges would not be charged because a witness described by Mobley as a neighbor in the recording claimed that Bridges identified himself as a law enforcement officer before the struggle escalated, contrary to the attorney's claim. Bridges was hired by the Highway Patrol in 1998, 1 year after Mobley. Highway Patrol officials declined comment about the complaint. Harris says they ought to be ashamed of themselves. Honestly, Bridges should have gotten charged. The cover story in the current issue of Indie Week is called Living History and written by Leah Taus. The ancient percussion of cicadas rattles in the treetops above Raleigh's Dorothea Dix Park as Kaya Little Turtle uses golden eagle feathers to gently fan wisps of smoke from a turtle shell. The Lumbee tribe member, adorned in ceremonial floral-stitched regalia, turns in four directions, smudging to the four winds, and the earthly fragrance of tobacco, sage, sweetgrass, and cedar smoke fills the air. It's a blistering August morning, and the normally bustling park is all but empty, save two tents under which a dozen tribal representatives and city officials sit in socially distanced lawn chairs. The ceremony is low-key out of necessity in the time of pandemic, but it is nonetheless historic. It's the city's first native land acknowledgement ceremony and one of only a few ever conducted in North Carolina. The recognition that indigenous people walked these hills for thousands of years before white colonizers arrived is a reclamation of history necessary for the city to begin the process of reckoning with its white supremacist roots. But it was also a call to action, a promise that the land's future, which officials currently hope will be a park for everyone after a stalled multi-million-dollar redevelopment, will celebrate the cultures white settlers attempted to erase. Gary Bird, president of Triangle Native American Society, says the property the Dix Park sits on today was originally land that natives inhabited, either by living there or using that as a place to rest, hunt, or live off the land. There's that history of the park itself that has native roots. Before Dix was a park, it was the state's first psychiatric hospital when it was founded in 1856. It housed Native Americans long before it accepted black people, and several members of the Lumbee tribe, including Riley Locklear, are buried in unmarked graves in the cemetery. Before that, it was a plantation whose fields were worked by enslaved African Americans. But 10,000 years ago, it was land that nomadic indigenous tribes passed through and while hunting large game, says historian and City of Raleigh Museum Director Ernest Dollar. While the evidence is sparse and more research is needed, a handful of artifacts, fragments of tools, weapons, date the earliest indigenous presence in the area to 8,000 BCE. Dollar says, for thousands and thousands of years, indigenous people roamed Raleigh. Our history is a short window compared to this bigger picture. By 1000 BCE, the nomadic tribes began to settle into agricultural communities. It was this rich society explorer John Lawson encountered in 1701, as described in his account, A New Voyage to Carolina. While passing through the town of Okeechobee, what is now Hillsborough, Lawson described ornate cabins hung with tapestries and stocked with bear fat, dried venison, and other lush provisions. He watched people play sports, sing, and feast. The tribe's chief, Eno Will, escorted Lawson south to the Falls of Neuse, whom the Okeechobee called Wequohome. There the two laid all night under the stars, discussing spirituality beside the babbling creek. What we now know as Wake County was a gray area between the territories of several large native communities, Tuscarora, the Catawba, and the Siouan, each with its own unique culture. Lawson's writing were partially blamed for the rapid expansion of white settlers into the native lands, and in 1711, he was killed during the onset of the Tuscarora War, the state's bloodiest known colonial conflict. The war, combined with diseases brought by white settlers, forced thousands of indigenous Tuscarora people to relocate west and join the Iroquois Confederacy near the Great Lakes. By the time European surveyors returned to the area in 1737, no native communities remained. Trey Roberts, a Liwa Saponi native who works with Dix Park Conservancy, says, "We were a group that was intentionally wiped out and our culture erased, and we're still here. We have a culture that's rich and important and beautiful, and we want to use this opportunity to teach people about it." Roberts grew up in Hollister, a small town of predominantly Haliwa Saponi, where he attended tribal classes that celebrated his culture. After moving to Raleigh, he says, it felt like the culture disappeared and no one really knew about it. He was drawn to working with the Conservancy because of the idea Dix could be the city's cultural heartbeat, a place for everyone that celebrates every aspect of the city's history. Roberts, who organized Saturday's event, was nervous before approaching the microphone to kick off the ceremony. Quote, we stand here today to make a statement that more work needs to be done to unlock the history, the story, and the injustices done to Native people in the area, including their displacement and removal. This isn't just a ceremony to recognize or bless the land of Dix Park, but this is the start of an ongoing commitment to celebrating our Native culture because we're still here. Unquote. That commitment will include an official proclamation from the city. Mayor Marianne Baldwin promised during the ceremony. She attended alongside Councillor David Cox and newly appointed Councillor Stormy Forte. We can't let that history be hidden, Baldwin told the Indy. We have to celebrate it. According to the 2010 census, North Carolina is home to about 122,000 Native Americans. Many don't see their culture reflected around them, Byrd said. History books downplay the genocide of the indigenous people, and the media often reduces their culture to a shallow stereotype. Because of this, many Native Americans suffer an invisibility complex, Byrd says. Without traditional attire, many tend to blend into a crowd. He said, our language has changed, our religion has changed, we're involved in politics on both sides of the aisle. Combating that invisibility means voices like Roberts must seize the space to be heard and tell their stories. For the city, it means taking the initiative to build real relationships and connections, says Dix Park Communications spokeswoman Laura Weldesofer. It's also how we are going to really make this place somewhere that everyone feels they have a connection to, but also that they are welcome and a part of. Little Turtle concluded the ceremony with a song of blessing. The earth, air, water, and trees contain medicine, he says. Music, too, he believes, has the power to heal. He beats a drum like a rapid heartbeat as his voice rings out over the ever-present hiss of cicadas. His eyes close as he sings. The drum beat slows, but the song continues to burst out of him from a place deep and raw. The trees sway slightly behind him, and further still, downtown's metal skyscrapers poke up through the skyline. Little Turtle says in a thick southern drawl, every single one of us comes from a rich cultural background with our songs, dances, languages, our cultural customs, our food. I appreciate this respect we've shown each other here today. All right, we pass over into culture, food, and drink, and the first article by Sarah Edwards, Nourishing Tradition. One night in 2018, Jasmine Michelle had an epiphany. She wanted to create a new kind of restaurant. Dreamboat was literally created on the couch, talking to one of my friends as I was working at a restaurant, Michelle says. I said, I'm going to do this, and it's going to be based on recipes that I was raised with. It was also my transition in realizing that the food industry is effing Eurocentric. I was tired of feeling I was wrong for that being my standard of food, beans, rice, plantains, and curry. That vision has come to life as Dreamboat Cafe, a pop-up meal service that Michelle runs out of her kitchen in Durham. The concept is a bit hard to summarize, but spend a little time on Dreamboat's Instagram and you'll get a better picture. There are the beautiful photos of food that we've come to expect from chefs, but the account is also full of zine excerpts, Golden Girls clips, and thoughtful primers on food apartheid, sustainability, and decolonization. Dreamboat Cafe, which also offers bake sales and virtual cooking classes, seems to sit right at the intersection of art, food, and heritage. Michelle says, The whole point of doing pop-up dinners was to have an extremely intimate gathering and have this kind of sacred intimacy among people. I try to keep that now that we've transitioned during COVID into pop-up deliveries and pickups. Michelle, born in southern Florida, has always been cooking, according to her sister, Jackie Morin, who owns a gourmet cotton candy company, Wonder Puff. Morin describes Michelle as a Gene Kelly in the kitchen, keeping burners and pots and pans organized and clean, and looking at peace while doing it. I've always been inspired by Jasmine, Morin says. She's able to create something from nothing. It's all rooted from love. That's how we were raised at home, and her ultimate goal is to make people feel loved. In 2012, Michelle moved to New York City to study at the French Culinary Institute. It was a change of pace from her conservative Muslim upbringing, she says, but working in the pressure cooker of the city's kitchen, she fell in love with pastries. The one piece of advice I got when I moved to New York from a family friend was to get myself lost, Michelle says, and find my way back home. After she graduated in 2014, that offhand advice became a philosophy over the next few years. Michelle traveled throughout the Southeast, working as a chef, and then moved to Hawaii in 2017 to farm. In Maui, she says, she felt safe to be black and brown and extremely angry. Here, she also began to dream about Dreamboat. In 2019, she moved to Durham to be near family, including sister, brother, and parents, who have all settled in North Carolina. She found a home back in the South and began to experiment more with the foods she grew up cooking and eating, like snapper, which she says has been her biggest pilgrimage home. The process of starting Dreamboat might not have been panned out as expected, given 2020's unique curveballs, but her original model of pop-up dinners at places like Jeddah's Tea made for a natural transition to pop-up dinner deliveries. As restaurants around the country have scrambled to find new takeout models in the pandemic, pop-up dining experiences have become a particular symbol of the moment. Events usually take place once or twice a week and stretch between 20 and 30 orders. They sell out fast. Some have themes. One was themed after Matilda. Another was a tribute to Sarah Bartman, the South African Khoikhoi woman who was enslaved and exploited in 19th century freak shows, while others are crafted around dietary needs or bulk orders. A recent family meal for four included, for $50, a whole roasted chicken, herb potatoes, salad, and brownies. That menu, according to Michelle, has all the basic building blocks of a family meal: meat, starch, a piece of green land, and something sweet. This is the Dreamboat approach to food. You don't just order a few items off the menu and call it a night. You're being nourished by a tradition. In July, at a Golden Girls-inspired pop-up with a pickup at the LGBTQ Center of Durham, cars lined up to get $30 meals inspired by Blanche, Rose, Dorothy, and Sophia. Fried shrimp wontons, green papaya salad, roasted plantains, and Wonder Puff cotton candy. Every time I've come across someone who loved Golden Girls as much as I did, it was because it was healing and funny, says Michelle, who has a warm, easy laugh. You weren't thinking while you were watching it, and somehow these women were your friends. That whole pop-up dinner was circled around what we're doing to heal ourselves and how we're taking up space while hurting, because everyone inevitably is. Bake sales and meal deliveries do the job for now, but Michelle has a vision that extends beyond the pandemic: a physical home, a brick-and-mortar American diner and French bistro, where everything on the menu is ethnic as hell. Cooking is how my family cared for people, and it's how I want to care for people, Michelle says. I want those I serve to feel freedom from pain, because existence for many is incredibly painful, now more than ever. All right, I think the rest of our time can be completely taken up with music and music-related articles, and the first one, here's another one called Machine Learning by Marta Nunez Pujols. The first time I experienced Marv live was when they opened Cochon's tape release show at Nightlight. It was back in November when nobody suspected that concerts would soon be relegated to longing memories. My first thought before the show was that Marv, the Carrboro-based synth duo, was an unlikely pairing with Cochon, that francophile post-punk femme-fronted band. But once the lights were off and the fog machine was on, Marv's otherworldly performance made me forget about context entirely. A minimalist, slow-paced excursion into sound created a deep, intriguing atmosphere before the music progressively opened up and enveloped me in a melancholy dream of New Age landscapes. At certain moments, I was reminded of the utopian leanings of the dearly missed Carl Sagan-inspired duo Sagan Youth, also known as Sagan Youth Boys. Active from 2010 to 2015, they released one of their albums on Tone Log, the local experimental label that released Marv's self-titled debut album in July. Available on vinyl and cassette, the debut lives up to the strong atmosphere created that night. The record has the mystery and distant beauty of a stranded spaceship being slowly devoured by glittering vegetation and time. Marv consists of Jeff Schilling, a contributor to the Triangle music scene since 2007, and Nathan Taylor, also known as techno producer and DJ Sponge Bath. When they started rehearsing in 2018, they didn't have a specific sound or aesthetic in mind. Schilling's previous project had just disbanded, and Taylor wanted to begin a collaborative project after working as a solo artist for well over a decade. The first setup was radically different than what Marv is today. Taylor played bass and a drum machine, while Schilling riffed on the keys. But this lasted for about two practices before boredom set in. So the duo decided to focus on synths, laying the groundwork for an experimental process that they still follow today. We fell into a weird routine of just starting practice without talking about a direction and noodling around, they said in a recent email chat, letting the machines take us where they may until we stumbled upon something that we were into. In late 2018, Marv opened for Cave and Object Hours, and right after stepping off the stage, they were asked to record an LP for Tone Log. They've been at work ever since, so much so they're almost finished recording the follow-up to that LP. There's something about Marv that makes you think of Tangerine Dream, though they mention Cluster and Conrad Schnitzler as more direct influences. Above all, they feel indebted to the local electronic music scene. We're heavily influenced by the local history of performers and labels from the Triangle, and we're just trying to add to that ecosystem, they say. During summer of 2019, the duo experienced an intense burst of creativity, recording almost one track per week. Their goal was to record a lot of material and then pick through it all for cohesion and quality. They decided to record each track in just one session, and this decision of not overthinking the arrangements contributes to the immediacy and unpredictability of the album. Even if Marv is not fundamentally improvisational, they walk a middle path between compositional intent and structured improv. Their interest in experimentation is emphasized by the collaborative nature of Marv. We try to let the machines take the role of lead improviser, they say. We follow where they lead down the random path. Marv is totally different compared to our other projects. There is more of an openness to divergent ideas and more attempts to try out different techniques and processes. There are a lot of variables that we embrace. The pandemic has been hard on performing artists, Marv included. The experience of a live show, they argue, is irreplaceable. We're not really into the whole live streaming culture that has blossomed up, they say. It feels sterile, weird, and easily co-opted by the digital platforms that make them possible. The release show was supposed to be April 4 at Nightlight in Chapel Hill with Hardface and the Bowls Bound Wag Trio. But despite the sadness of all the shows that never got to happen, and the myriad hardships that performers have had to confront this year, MARF demonstrates the resilience of our local music scene. It's been difficult to focus on recording and practicing with everything going on, they say. At the same time, it has also been therapeutic, a small response to the tragedy of it all. Music has got to be a part of whatever future we're heading toward, and we're committed to being a part of whatever that might look like in the Triangle. Chris Vitiello writes this column, How to Get a Buzz. How do musicians improvise together when they can't be together? Bird Songs of the Necromancer is the North Carolina-based experimental group Cyanotype's idea to that question. Releasing August 7th on Bandcamp, it features 8 musicians who use extended techniques, unorthodox ways of making sounds with classical instruments, to bridge the gap. Cyanotype is a loose collective that consists mostly of classically trained musicians who have been playing together in various ensembles for years. They don't have a set repertoire. Instead, someone starts playing. Others listen a bit and respond, and that guiding and reacting guides them into a kind of groupthink. It's electrifying to hear these real-time decisions and reactions in person, which has been captured well on their previous, essentially live recordings. But Bird Songs, made entirely under quarantine, is different. Violist Dan Rucha says, There's a long history of these albums that get constructed over the internet or through the mail from peoples in far corners of the world, sending files back and forth, remixing and layering. But that's very much a process of iteration, right? Using the mail as a compositional tool. We're thinking about this as an improvisational tool. Disclosure. Rucci writes about music for the Indie Week. For the 8 pieces on the album, Rucci put together scores that merely listed 4 musicians in a certain order. First musician would record a 5-minute improvisation in a single, unrehearsed take and send it back to Rucci. Then the second musician would receive the track with a specific time window in which they would improvise to the recording without listening to it in advance. That would be mixed and sent to the third musician, and so on. Instead of iterative composition, it's a process of accumulating improvisation that resembles Cyanotype's live works to create that unique sense of connection. Since each musician is improvising separately to a different accumulating piece, quarantine itself can be said to be a fifth member of the ensemble. But the extended techniques the group always employs are still the binding element. Jeb Bishop, trombone, and Laurent Estapi, saxophone, open Watch a Wasp with an insectoid sound like a drone hovering overhead. Rucci says, Jeb does a lot of stuff, using breath in interesting sorts of ways to change the timbre and sound coming out. He does stuff with his embouchure to get a buzz, and he hums and speaks while playing to create different kinds of pitch sets and multiphonics. Laurent has a similar sort of vocabulary, but for him the sax has a lot more to do with using the valves to create different kinds of sounds. Rucci continues, key clicks, different pitch stuff, playing with different fingerings for things. These kind of techniques aren't just cool noises. There's also a politics to it. While the music that has been played on classical instruments has changed and expanded continuously since they were invented centuries ago, the white Eurocentric conventions of how those instruments are to be played have stayed about the same. Many trained musicians take those conventions as an unquestionable truth, but others see them as a silencing of possibilities of expression, a muffling of unconventional voices. Extended technique is a form of dissent. Its aesthetics is a politics. Estapi's valve clicks and odd breaths, heard early in the Threnody for Breonna Taylor, sound unnervingly like something outside getting ready to burst in. The scrabbling grows to percussive thumping before Jill Christensen's oppressive electronic washes and organ sounds overcome them amid Michael Thomas Jackson's clarinet scream. on Oakland Drive, David Menestra's bass, and Ruchet use unconventional bowing to get atmospheric sounds, like the instruments are being scrubbed with steel wool, creating a soundscape for more tonal playing to emerge from later. The piece ends with Jackson talking unintelligibly through his clarinet, giving the effect of eavesdropping on people passing on a busy sidewalk. I'm playing second on that track after David, Richard says. I'm doing vertical bowing, where you bow parallel to the strings rather than perpendicular to get a wah-wah, whooshy, airy sound. I'm going light with the tension and pressure and using a lot of bow speed. Menestra also hits the wooden part of the bow against the body of the bass to make percussive clacks. That's something David does a lot more of than me, Richard says. The bass lends itself more to that. There's more physicality to it, and it can handle a lot more abuse. In its accumulating improvisational form, through the expressive use of extended technique, Bird Songs of the Necromancer is an example of how to overcome physical and emotional isolation, to remain part of a musical community, and to expand one's vocabulary when old ones are failing. Rucha says, saying you can only make this one kind of sound or range of sounds, it's representative of all the various forms of cultural hegemony that we're unpacking and talking about right now. I'm not going to be so bold as to claim that we're upsetting the system. We're not. But it's still a way of thinking about different ways that things could be said or done. And I don't believe I have time to read any more complete articles. I'll just mention two or three articles left in this week's edition of Indie Week. One is Keisha Jennings' report, Radio Dynasty, which is about DJ Stamp's Street Flow Mix Show, a hip-hop rite of passage at Duke for 26 years. And another one by Brian Reed, Heavy Duty. Quarantine can't contain these four cathartic new albums from the local metal scene. An article by Nick Parker, Rooting for the Home Screen. You don't need your local cinema to stream a movie online, but your local cinema needs you. And at the beginning of the Indie Week, Sue Snetton, artist and illustrator, is talked to for 15 minutes. And she is well known to most indie illustrators community because she was an illustrator for the indie herself. Before I rush away to play the theme song, Last Notes, we are on a podcast at www.ncreadingservice.org for this issue of Indie Week. I'm John Feddersen, reading for a blind and print.